The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
This is a song about parts of the brain. I'm singing it to memorize the name. The ideas here may be simplistic, but matching meaning and rhyme is a tough logistic.
Humans have long held a fascination for the human brain. We chart it, we described it, we've drawn it, we've mapped it.
So scientists have studied the brain for centuries, but it's only been in the last 15 years or so that we've discovered one of the most fascinating things, and that is that your brain changes every single day.
Most people, when they first look at a fresh human brain, they say it doesn't look like what you're typically looking at.
You may not realize it, but your brain actually processes information in two very distinct ways, like when you look at this photo.
The cerebral cortex has four main lobes, with names from the nearby skull bones.
It controls what you think, how you're listening to this now, and why you're bothering. It's the subject of the most fascinating studies in science, and yet it's one of the most underdeveloped areas of medical research. In fact, as we'll hear from a leading neurosurgeon, we still don't really understand how the brain works, only which bits do what, and how it gets its information. What goes on in it is also at the root of all our literature, our art, our society and our politics. So it's often at its most interesting when it starts to warp and misfire. The novelist and cultural critic Lisa Opinionese has long been fascinated by the mind, particularly since she discovered the history of the 19th century alienists, or mind doctors, now known as psychiatrists. Her latest book is Trials of Passion, an investigation of three sensational crimes committed, as her subtitle tells it, in the name of love and madness.
On Thursday, 24th August, a large and unusually feminine and affluent public crammed into Brighton's new courthouse, well before proceedings started. Completed in 1869, this ample red brick structure trimmed with stone and wearing a royal coat of arms over its west entrance on the corner of Church Street, conveniently close to Grand Parade, proved too small for the excitement the case had generated. Many were turned away and had to settle for the numerous press accounts that appeared in papers across the nation. The hearing began shortly after 11. According to the Daily News's account, the accused sat in a corner of the ordinary prisoner's dock, being attired in a black silk dress, black lace shawl, and black bonnet with veil. Christiana's demeanour was throughout quiet and self-possessed, but she occasionally glanced round the court with evident interest in the scene. Other papers describe her with a pencil in her hand, methodically taking notes, or looking about her like a diva and acknowledging acquaintances. The Times has her fair, well-dressed and self-possessed, and smiling as descriptions were given of the pains taken to trace the band administering the poisons. Like some observer of her own fate, Christiana seems to be enjoying the excitement she has generated around her. At least on the surface, she seems indifferent to the hearing's possible outcome. Her dramatic black may be a signal of modesty or of mourning. It is tempting to see in her choice of dress an echo of Wilkie Collins's fatally seductive heroine in Armadale, the poisoning and poisonous Lydia Gwilt, who hides her powers behind the ladylike garb of a thick black veil, a black bonnet, and a black silk dress. Christiana's assiduous note-taking is also much reported. She is evidently an educated woman, and one for whom writing counts. The fact that Charles Beard held on to her letters for so long before destroying some and handing others over to the police may also suggest that these letters carried some kind of resonance for him, as they patently did for her. It is interesting to note that unstoppable writing seems to play a crucial part in many of these excessive and dangerous love stories, from Christiana's to our own contemporary stalkers.
That was Christiane Edmonds, the first of three case studies in Lisa Epeninesi's Trials of Passion, Crimes in the Name of Love and Madness, Lisa. England, France and the US between 1870 and 1914. So it's quite a wide canvas. Tell us to start with a bit more about Christiane.
Well, Christiane Edmonds is a very mysterious woman. You know, when you're not dealing with fiction and you can't fill in the blank, you have to go through trial reports, you have to go through case material if that exists. She appears, if you like, sideways through the announcement put up in Brighton by the local police asking if anyone knows about these poison packages that have been sent to rather well-known and highly reputed people in the Brighton area. And when the police, in search of who might have done this, come to her as a victim of the crime, she says, "I think you'll have trouble finding this out." And she turns out to be a woman of, well, between 35 and 43. She's a woman of the middle classes. Her father, again, I discovered, had been a very, very well-known South Coast architect. She lives with her mother. One of her sisters has perhaps committed suicide. One of her brothers runs the asylum stroke prison on Robben Island, the one to which Nelson Mandela was later committed. And it seems, this is the person to whom she writes her letters, has fallen in love with her doctor, Dr. Charles Beard. And in order to win his love, we're not sure about this because it's not clear whether this is imagined or real. I suspect there's a little of both in play. She decides to poison his wife and does this by going around to visit, and they're all friends. She pokes rather violently a poisoned chocolate cream bought from Maynard's, the very well-known chocolatier in Brighton, into the mouth of Emily Beard, Mrs. Beard.
But Emily spits it out, so she doesn't actually get poisoned.
But she doesn't die of it. In any case, she does have a vile taste in her mouth, vomits. Anyhow, there's a wave of poisonings through chocolate in Brighton throughout that summer of 1870. Eventually, a little boy has one of these chocolates and dies of it.
Because she's leaving them on shop shelves. She's impregnating bags of chocolate with strychnine and putting them back in shops. That's so right. This poor little boy gets given one.
It's very hard to trace a single chocolate back to Christiane and her poisonings. And in fact, in the court, her defence tried to say that perhaps this was circumstantial and couldn't be traced back to her. She tries to point the finger at the chocolate shop, the Maynard's shop, because she's very, very keen for everyone to know that, you know, there is somebody responsible for this wave of poisonings. And it's not just one person who has been poisoned. It's not just Mrs. Beard, the wife of the man that Christiane loves, but all these other people. There's this plague of poisonings, if you like, in Brighton, which should not be attributed to her. Charles will discover because he has broken off relations with her. Certainly, she was madly in love with him. She may have been, and this is the other part of my book, she may have indeed been suffering from a kind of madness which could be called anything and was called anything from erotomania to nymphomania to hysteria by the mind doctors of her time. And you know, I'm also very interested in these cases because of the way in which these alienists, these nascent specialists in the field of psychiatry, think about her and how that plays into the whole courtroom sequencing of events. Because what she's actually finally being tried for is the death of the child, the 4.5-year-old boy. The wisdom of the lawyers and the judge decides that her affair with Beard will not be spoken of.
Now, you're a novelist as well as a historian. Do you find it frustrating having to pull back from that last bit of imagining?
It's a great tease, isn't it? And I like to tease in fiction as well. So perhaps it's better not to know absolutely, because these things, these love affairs, these affairs of passion, these crimes of passion, what goes on in people's minds is never quite what takes place in the real. You know, I wrote a book about love before this, and I was trying to concentrate in that book more on, if you like, the beneficent side of love. But we all know that what happens within romantic love is very often in the eyes of the person who is experiencing it. There's an old of illusion, and the illusion sometimes moves quite seamlessly into delusion. I think what I was trying to do in this book is it's really, in a way, a companion piece as well as all the other things that it is to the books that I've done before about the history of the mind doctoring professions and their relationship to the way we think of being human and the way we are human, what we allow is emotion, what constitutes normality, what constitutes insanity, you know, where the dividing lines lie. In this book, it was particularly difficult because the law, of course, is so rigidly rational. Where do the emotions play into this terrain of the courtroom, into this terrain of the law and reason? This comes at a time just a little later where criminology also takes up this theme, if you like, so that you no longer are somebody who commits a crime, and you may do it once in your life, but you may be somebody who is now born criminal, and this is something which you are determined to do. And this is not so far away from what goes on at the moment in terms of argument either. I mean, we now talk about the neurosciences, perhaps being able to locate areas of the brain which are linked to criminality.
So now, after that case in England, we move forward some time to France in 1880 to Marie Bière, who shot her lover.
I wanted to compare, because the growth of the psychiatric professions and the mind doctoring is very prominent in France, and it becomes more and more prominent through these court cases which propagate the language of mind doctoring. So not only is hysteria an everyday word for people of all classes, because the press is also very popular and is allowed to report trials ahead of time and all the way through in France. It's a very open press.
But also the legal systems are different, and you make the point that in France they didn't have an adversary law system. So she was able, Marie was able to talk, and she actually made her own case, didn't she? And won people over to her way of seeing things.
That's right. And she's also allowed, because she didn't kill this man, she only wounded him, she's also allowed to be in the same room with him and guide the questioning that he undergoes. Throughout continental Europe, by this time, you begin to have medics as part of the judicial apparatus, something which still doesn't exist here in any kind of systematic way. I mean, they're not hired by the state. They are hired by the state in France. In Marie Bière's case, what's so interesting is that she's really a girl from a petty bourgeois family, although she rises to the position of artiste and singer and has quite a reputation at her time. And she applies the morality, if you like, of the petty bourgeois to the man who is her lover. And this man sees himself as being an aristocrat, which he is, and somebody who can live out a kind of Don Giovanni form of sexual relations and gender relations. And the two clash. So she thinks this man is really in love with her and you know, will somehow take care of her throughout her life. He thinks he's having an affair, and this has nothing to do with marriage. When Marie Bière gets pregnant and doesn't have an abortion, that too comes up in the case very scandalously. He does not think that he needs to look after this child. He doesn't want her to have this child. She falls in love with her child, and the child becomes far more important in many ways than him. And when the child dies, she decides in her mind that this is actually his doing, decides that she needs to both retrieve her honor and have some revenge. And the entire system of relations between the sexes goes on trial through her case.
It's the most tragic of the three, really, isn't it? It's like a little chamber opera, isn't it? It would make a brilliant opera. Now let's just move on to the third one, which is, the, in a way, the most rackety. And it's also the most horrid, isn't it? It's when Harry Thor, who's a millionaire, killed the architect Stanford White, shot him dead in a restaurant for an alleged slight to the young woman who Thor had married and was indeed himself abusing.
It's a horrendous case, and in a way it's the most modern of the cases. We're in America's Gilded Age, and we're dealing with a man who exhibits characteristics which we now have a great familiarity with through not only psychiatric professions, but through great many thrillers and everything else. So Harry K. Thaw is effectively what we would now call a paranoid, who has various perverse sexual tendencies. But he sees himself, and this is his delusion, if you like, as the great honorable protector of virtue. It's a terrible court case. It's a terrible court case because millions are poured into it. But it's also a court case which mesmerizes all of America and indeed Europe. It's reported throughout the European press too. One of the reasons it's reported is, again, that it's the scenario of the 20th century, if you like, in which you have this poor little rich girl, Evelyn Nesbit, who is very beautiful, who is a model, who doesn't look like anyone else, who is wonderfully slim, as the new century wants its women to be.
There's a thing about her, she's like prepubescent almost, yes. Her body. And I found that fascinating, that this modern look that they were lusting after.
Yes, and it's the modern look which attracts men who have slight, we might call perversions. I mean, it's all in the news at the moment, isn't it? I mean, you know, this love for the girl who isn't yet woman, although she's just about of age now, she wasn't of age then, and whom the camera adores. Now, I have to say that Evelyn Nesbit, I think, really did love Stanford White, and he was really rather kind to her in an older married man's...
Well, he raped her, drugged her and raped her when she was 17.
I know, but she decided that this was all right.
Now, she wasn't awake when it happened.
Because I think she, after that, fell in love with him. But she describes it graphically in court. And, of course, this mesmerizes everyone. And it's reported word for word in throughout the press. Harry K. Thaw, this horrible man who she then marries, who I think is far worse than Stanford White in many respects, because he literally is out of control, and I think he is quite mad, then proceeds to do far worse things to her than Stanford K. White ever did. But she stays with him because, you know, she really has nowhere else to go, and she likes to think that she sees his good side, his childlike side. One of the terms that's applied to him is that he has suffered from a brainstorm. In other words, he's been attacked through his delusion, in his nerves, and he cannot control his actions.
Seems like alcoholic derangement to me.
It's just that he was also mad quite often, and not always with alcohol.
You made the point at the beginning that quite often writing, obsessive writing, plays a part. Evelyn Nesbit, in this third case, she actually took control because she wrote about it all afterwards. She went on to live and to prosper and took control of the story. That's which also makes it more modern.
And she has this long life, plays in the Palladium in London.
And was the subject of a film.
And was the subject of several films. And appears in the wonderful novel Ragtime.
And none of these three people were actually executed.
One of the things I look at in the book is a changing relationship as well to capital punishment. The reason some of these cases are quoted still in America is, of course, because the death penalty still exists and, you know, how do you play insanity into the death penalty?
Trials of Passion is published by Virago. From the safety of earlier centuries, we now move to the jeopardy of our own, as recounted by neurosurgeon Henry Marsh in a new memoir, Do No Harm, subtitled Stories of Life, Death and Brain Surgery. The fascination of this book lies not just in the operations he has spent his working life carrying out, but in the portrait he paints of a medical specialism that is not always populated by the calm and detached medics we would hope would be in charge of this most intricate and delicate part of ourselves. It's not only the knives, but the emotions that can go wrong. In conversation with Richard Lee, he describes why he first became such a specialist.
Neurosurgery involves the surgical treatment of patients with diseases and injuries of the brain and spine. These are rare problems, so there are only a small number of neurosurgeons and neurosurgical departments in comparison to other medical specialties. I never saw any neurosurgery as a medical student. We were not allowed into the neurosurgical theatre in the hospital where I trained. It was considered too specialised and arcane for mere students. Once, when walking down the main theatre corridor, I had had a brief view through the small porthole window of the neurosurgical theatre's door of a naked woman, anaesthetised, her head completely shaven, sitting bolt upright on a special operating table. An elderly and immensely tall neurosurgeon, his face hidden by a surgical face mask and a complicated headlight fixed to his head, was standing behind her. With enormous hands, he was painting her bare scalp with dark brown iodine antiseptic. It looked like a scene from a horror film. 3 years later, I found myself in that same neurosurgical operating theatre, watching the younger of the two consultant neurosurgeons who worked in the hospital operating on a woman with a ruptured cerebral aneurysm. I'd been qualified as a doctor for 1.5 years by then and was already disappointed and disillusioned with the thought of a career in medicine. I was working at the time as a senior house officer, or SHO for short, in my teaching hospital's intensive care unit. One of the anaesthetists who worked on the ITU, seeing that I looked a little bored, had suggested that I come down to the operating theatre to help her prepare a patient for a neurosurgical operation. It was unlike any other operation I'd seen, which had usually seemed to involve long bloody incisions and the handling of large and slippery body parts. This operation was done with an operating microscope through a small opening in the side of the woman's head, using only fine microscopic instruments with which to manipulate her brain's blood vessels. Aneurysms are small, balloon-like blowouts on the cerebral arteries that can, and often do, cause catastrophic hemorrhages in the brain. The aim of the operation is to place a minute spring-loaded metal clip across the neck of the aneurysm, just a few millimetres across, to prevent the aneurysm bursting. There is a very real danger that the surgeon, working at several inches depth in the centre of the patient's head, in a narrow space beneath the brain, will inadvertently burst the aneurysm while he dissects it free from the surrounding brain and blood vessels and tries to clip it. Aneurysms are thin, fragile walls, yet they have high-pressure arterial blood within them. Sometimes the wall is so thin that you can see the swirling dark red vortices of blood within the aneurysm, made enormous and sinister by the magnification of the operating microscope. If the surgeon ruptures the aneurysm before he can clip it, the patient will usually die, or at least suffer a catastrophic stroke, a fate that can easily be worse than death. The staff in the theatre was silent. There was none of the usual chatter and talk. Neurosurgeons sometimes describe aneurysm surgery as akin to bomb disposal work, though the bravery required is of a different kind, as it is a patient's life that is risk and not the surgeon's. The operation I was watching was more like a blood sport than a calm and dispassionate technical exercise with the quarry a dangerous aneurysm. There was the chase, the surgeon cautiously stalking his way beneath the patient's brain towards the aneurysm, trying not to disturb it to where it lay deep within the brain. And then there was the climax as he caught the aneurysm, trapped it and obliterated it with a glittering spring-loaded titanium clip, saving the patient's life. More than that, the operation involved the brain, the mysterious substrate of all thought and feeling, of all that was important in human life, a mystery, it seemed to me, as great as the stars at night and the universe around us. The operation was elegant, delicate, dangerous, and full of profound meaning. What could be finer, I thought, than to be a neurosurgeon? I had the strange feeling that this is what I'd wanted to do all my life, even though it was only now that I'd roused it. It was love at first sight. The operation went well. The aneurysm was successfully clipped without causing a catastrophic stroke or hemorrhage, and the atmosphere in the operating theatre was suddenly happy and relaxed. I went home that night and announced to my wife that I was going to be a brain surgeon. She looked a little surprised, given that I'd been so undecided about what sort of doctor I should be, but she seemed to think the idea made sense. Neither of us could have known then that my obsession with neurosurgery and the long working hours and the self-importance it produced in me would lead to the end of our marriage 25 years later.
You take the title of your neurosurgical memoir, Do No Harm, from the Hippocratic injunction, always to have the best interests of the patient at heart. But why is this so cruelly difficult for brain surgeons?
Well, all medicine has risks, but in brain surgery, the risks are very great. And however good you are every so often, you are going to have an operation going catastrophically wrong. So you have to accept, as part of your work, you are going to, as we call it, wreck a few people. Now, of course, sure, the justification for that is that you help more people, it's for the greater good, but it's still an odd sort of job where you have to accept you are going to cause a lot of harm.
You describe the operations as a kind of combination of butchery, of hacking through the skull with drills and saws, and then the most delicate cuts.
Yes, there is a contrast between what you do to the skull and what you do to its contents. But surgery is an addiction. I say it's a blood sport. What provides the emotional intensity, actually, is one's intense concern the patient should do well. I mean, occasionally if an operation's gone well, I'll tell the patient afterwards, you know, I really rather enjoyed doing that, and they look offended that something that's been so horrible for them has actually been a source of enjoyment for me. But I then say, well, look, if you think about it, the last thing you want is to be operated on by a surgeon who doesn't enjoy doing it, and then they laugh.
It seems a world away from what you might imagine to be a cerebral pursuit.
Well, this is one reason why I've written the book. I feel very strongly that we should treat our patients as equals, which, as you know, often doesn't happen. But there's another side to that, of course, which if doctors are going to treat patients as their equals, patients have to understand that doctors are not gods. They're fallible human beings, and they have problems and difficulties like everybody else. And, of course, that's an uncomfortable thought when you're ill. I know many neurosurgeons, and there's a wide variety of personality types. Some other medical specialties, the standard joke is orthopaedic surgeons are all cut from the same cloth. They're all big, optimistic, positive rugger players. Neurosurgeons, it's more difficult. But you have to, in some way, enjoy risk. Even with minor, simple operations, you're still immensely focused in a heightened state. And that's enjoyable. But what drives it is anxiety that the patient will not come to harm.
You don't try to hide your mistakes or your anger, your impatience sometimes with your pettifogging management, but perhaps the heart of the book comes in the shortest chapter, your account of the emergency admission and operation to remove a tumour from the brain of your own three-month-old son. How did this experience shape your medical career?
Well, it's very difficult to know, because I don't know what sort of doctor I would have been if my son hadn't had a brain tumour. I always told the children's parents that my son had had a brain tumour. And that actually was very helpful, because they knew immediately. I knew what they were experiencing, and I'd like to think it made me a good doctor as a result. But I don't think I became a brain surgeon because of my experiences of my son. I think it was the nature of the work.
You say that doctors can't suffer enough.
If there's anything the book is really about, it's about this problem of trying to be both compassionate and detached at the same time. Doctors are pulled in two opposite directions. On the one hand, the only ethical injunction is do as you would be done by. You should never operate, you should never treat a patient in a way that you yourself or your family, you'd want them to be treated. But at the same time, it's almost impossible to actually treat somebody who's close to you, because you're too nervous, you're too anxious. I once operated on a close friend with a malignant brain tumour. It was a very, very simple operation. It was almost impossible. So you're torn in these two opposite directions and trying to find a balance between professional objectivity and emotional involvement is difficult. And you can get too involved. I've made the wrong decision sometimes because I'd got to know the patient too well. I cared for them too much. It's possible to care too much. So what often passes for the arrogance of surgeons is sometimes it's the power corrupts. Doctors are great power, particularly surgeons, and often we're all corrupted by it to some extent. But it's also self-protection to enable one to do the work.
You say that sometimes if you become too involved, you become almost too anxious. Is that a physical reaction? Your hands shaking?
Yes, you just find it very difficult. No, when you're a surgeon, your hands don't shake, really, when you're nervous. But just you feel very, very tense.
You say that the philosopher's struggles with the mind-body problem are a waste of time, and you prefer to reflect instead on the awe, the amazement and surprise that consciousness is just the electrochemical chatter of 100 billion nerve cells. Do you think we'll ever understand how brains give rise to consciousness, or even what kind of answer to that question would be?
What strikes me as extraordinary about the incontrovertible fact that thought is a physical electrochemical process is it elevates matter. It doesn't degrade free will or human beings in any way. It means we don't really understand matter. Some people say it's somehow be totally impossible for the brain to understand itself. I don't know, because I can't predict the future. But I think it's very unlikely. And if you think about it, science is based on experimentation. And firstly, it's difficult to experiment on human beings. Secondly, you can't experiment on consciousness. If you think about it, well, if you start falling asleep and then you're trying to record your consciousness, you can't. It's a totally subjective phenomenon. We don't understand the basis of consciousness. Is it that every 100 billionth brain cell is a minute 100 billionth fragment of consciousness in it? Why is it when you put a certain number of brain cells together, consciousness arises? We just don't know. Admittedly, nobody understands the brain. But I think as a neurosurgeon, one's feet are firmly planted on the ground, as opposed to some neuroscientists who like to pontificate.
Henry Marsh talking to Richard Lee. Do No Harm is published by Orion. Now, go home and relax after this week's heady listen. If you're up for more from the more challenging frontiers of psychology, Do look out on the website for Hadley Freeman's terrific interview with Andrew Solomon, who has just won the Wellcome Prize for his book Far From the Tree. If you prefer to listen than to read, you can find him on this very podcast in an episode titled Literature on the Couch. This week's Guardian Weekly also looks at science with a report on how plans for the European Extremely Large Telescope are taking shape on a Chilean mountaintop. If you'd like something a little lighter for the holiday weekend, test your knowledge of May Day in literature with our quiz. If you've come to us through SoundCloud or iTunes, why don't you become a regular subscriber? And do join in the conversation on our website at theguardian.com/books. We always love to hear from you, and we're always open to suggestions as to which books or literary issues you might like us to cover on this podcast. For this week then, from me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Tim Mabey, goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.